Up with a title for this talk. I was thinking about it, and basically what I did was I went back to my original job description where they wanted me to work on improving yield and quality on the in the coastal plain region and in the Atlantic Coast Flatwoods region, as you can see here on these maps. Now, I'm sure a lot of you know that a lot of this work I'm going to talk about has been in collaboration with Clemson University. I actually have an office on the Clemson University campus, or Clemson University facility at the PD Research and Education Center. This is a 2,400-acre facility, and for those of you who are on campus, I just wanted to make you a little jealous. We have lots of free parking right up next to the building. Okay, what I want to talk about today, I hope I can get through all these, because I overplanned as usual. Got it from my mentor, Dr. Cothran. But I want to talk a little bit about the research we've done with irrigation, with a little bit with on conservation tillage, some of the research we did with fiber quality, and then if I got time at the end, a couple new research areas we've just getting into. Well, if I would have drove into Florence for my interview rather than flown, I might have thought twice about taking a job where I was supposed to improve yield and quality. This is a shot taken from an airplane, the U.S. Air Service from Florence to Charlotte, and you can see the high amount of variability in this field. Here, this part of the field is water sitting in the field. Down in here, we have an area where the plants were flooded out due to water sitting in the field. And not several hundred yards away, we have low areas of growth because the cotton, or because the soils couldn't hold enough water to support the plant growth. Highly variable soils in this region. Well, one way we can take care of some of the variability is with irrigation. This happens to be a field I took a little bit of data in a couple years ago in northeast South Carolina. We can get rid of some of the variation with irrigation, obviously not all of it. Center pivots are good tools. North and South Carolina, though, we've got a problem. Our fields are small. A lot of our fields are small. Average field size in both states are only 25 acres. And not only are these fields small, but they're irregular in shape. So when I first got to Florence, or when I first got started working in irrigation, I got lucky enough to work with Dr. Carl Camp, who was an ag engineer, and he was interested in drip irrigation for humid regions. So I got on this project, which was one of the first drip irrigation projects in the humid region on cotton. These are the treatments we had with in this experiment that we did for 4 years. Basically, what we were trying to see is on these sandy soils, do we have to put a lateral under every row? Can we put a lateral under every other row? Or can we put a lateral under every other row, rather, and save about a third of the installation costs? And then we had nitrogen treatments also in this study. Gossamer Comex was big at the time, so we did this test to see if we could use Gossamer Comex specifically to put in drip irrigation, put out nitrogen, rather. And this is the yield data, and this is what we found year in and year out in our area, that about half the time irrigation pays, half the time it doesn't. Two of the 4 years we got an irrigation response. One thing we did find was no difference between putting the laterals under every row or in every other row middle. At the time, that was a difference of about $600 an acre for installing versus $1,000 an acre, a big difference. But another fairly impressive finding was that by using Gossamer Comex, we got the same yields but applied 30% less nitrogen. And we ran Gossamer Comex every week to let it tell us if it needed nitrogen, and we would put out 10 pounds when it said put out some nitrogen. And so back at the time, nitrogen was relatively cheap, not that big a deal. As nitrogen prices have risen, though, 30% reduction is a pretty good rate amount. And finally, I'm not going to talk about this too much, but Judy Bredo in New Orleans and Gail Davidonis, when we put this study in, they put got an APHIS Pro to measure individual fiber properties on individual bowls. They got that in the early 90s too, and this was one of the first studies where we collected bowl samples. And what we did find in this study, and Judy published a lot on this, was that irrigation did affect and kind of reduce the within canopy variability for some of the fiber properties. We ran quite a few studies over the years with this drip system, not just those first 4 years, and this is just the yield data difference between irrigated and dry land, showing again about half the time we got a response to irrigation on this particular soil. Let me skip this one. Moving on to the conservation tillage research. Done quite a bit of work with conservation tillage. As the names imply, we're in the Atlantic flatwoods and coastal plains, so it really wasn't an erosion problem that we were dealing with. We were dealing with soil productivity. So we did work with winter cereals and legumes in the rotations, trying to improve conservation tillage, trying to get more soil organic matter, better soil quality. More recently, we've done a little work with the summer legumes to supplying nitrogen. This is just a shot, and that's about all I'm going to say about our legumes, our cover crop work right now. But this is a shot of a typical coastal plain soil. The soil is low water hold capacity, a horizon. It has a little bit of organic matter, but they're loams or sandy loams. On top of that, that soil lays on top of a root restricting hard pan, the E horizon. That is a basically sandy loam soil also, but the organic matter has been leached out. And so what we have to do, and this has been done since the 1970s, is use tillage tools to break up that root-restricting hardpan. But even the surface can get highly compacted. These are some roots where we did strict no-till for a number of years, and you can see the roots didn't get very far into the ground. Well, this is the tillage tool that they used, and this has been recommended annual subsoiling for since before 1970. These things run up under the row, break up the hard pan, break up the compaction. And the thing about these things is they take quite a bit of power, about 20 to 25 horsepower per shank. Some number I just found recently on the internet said that they take 2 to 3 gallons of fuel per acre. So if we can reduce our use of this particular tillage tool and increase, or it would be a good thing, big savings in energy. And here's some data we took from a wheat soybean study that we were doing where we ripped up the soil the first year with subsoiling equipment, and then just simply left the field alone, left the traffic off those areas, and measured how fast the soil would recompact on its own. And we found, as you can see, we found a nice linear response with recompaction, which is coned index, this is just basically soil strength, with cumulative rainfall. And these soils become root restricting at about 2 megapascals, which is about 3,000 millimeters of rainfall in this study. And since at Florence we get about 1,200 millimeters of rainfall, that means we should only have to run those tillage tools every couple of years at most. And we did do a cotton study looking at that, and we did find indeed that with subsoiling, without subsoiling, either 1 or 2 years after it was ripped up, gave us no significant differences in yield compared to annual subsoiling. Which, now that we have GPS tillage equipment, or GPS steering assistance, this kind of work might become much more important and more saving. Okay, we all know the reasons for using conservation tillage. When you go down to the bottom line, usually it was for better soil quality, is what we were looking for in the coastal plain soils, as I said before. But in all our data, with the conservation tillage yields, were usually the same as conventional tillage yields, unless we didn't get stands or we didn't control the weeds, and then yields were less. So we threw a kitchen sink experiment at it, basically where we put in these long plots, and what we wanted to do that spanned several soil map units, and we wanted to look at a bunch of different treatments and see where, if we could find where we can make soil conservation tillage work better. And so in the experiment, we had rotations of either continuous cotton with a rye cover crop, or cotton rotated with corn, as you can see here. We had no-till and conventional till, or conservation tillage and conventional tillage. And then we also had the nematologist and entomologist at our facility working with us. And so we split these plots. Half of them received the nematicide rate atemic, which also controlled thrips, and half of them did not. As you can see here, the thrips damage in these plants. We started this study, well, actually we planted the rye in the fall of 1996 to start this study. And then in 1998, North America experienced the turn of the century drought. And this is our monthly deviation from average rainfall that we got from during that drought from 1998. Through 2002. And interestingly, though we didn't find differences in the years before with conservation tillage, and we didn't find differences in the first year here, we did find significant yield increases every year during this turn of the century drought for conservation tillage. This averaged to be about a 25% yield increase. Very interestingly, all the other kitchen sink treatments we threw at it, soil type, nematicides, rotation, cover crops, they didn't matter, and they didn't interact with tillage in this study. But during these drought years, it was just tillage. Also, at the same time we were running this study, we were running a study on some plots that we've had in no-till since 1978. And in that study, we published this in 2004, but from 1998 to 2001, we had corn, wheat, and soybeans on those long-term tillage plots. And you can see the yield response from cotton in our study was 26%, but basically we got no response for corn during these drought years. For any of these small, for these grains during these drought years. Now, I don't have a real good reason for this, but this is my hypothesis. It's pretty well known that the impact of conservation tillage on rainfall infiltration and stopping soil evaporation occurs before canopy closure. And so with cotton, which we were growing in 38-inch rows, and whereas the corn, soybeans, and wheat were in narrower rows, we start with cotton, we start to get flowering and reproductive growth prior to canopy closure. With corn, soybeans, and wheat, canopy closure stops or is done well before it starts putting on its yield. And if you look at some data that Gene Gwynn and Jack Mooney collected and published back in 1984, there's a nice relationship between the leaf water potential and percent boll retention. So basically what conservation tillage was doing for us was increasing, giving us a day or two to hold a few more bolls in these plots, and then increased yield. and I calculated per bowl yield increase, just using a rough 2 grams of fiber per bowl. And it does seem to make sense here that, where's my pointer? Basically, we're getting a bowl per plant. In the years, we got the big yield response down to a bowl every five plants for a little bit less. And I think that's probably what's explaining our yield increase with conservation tillage there. Okay, global climate change predictions for the Southeast, if you trust the global climate change models, are saying that we're expecting the same total precipitation, but they're going to be more intense, and thus we're going to have more periods of drought. And I think conservation tillage, especially for dryland cotton or rain-fed cotton in our region, not necessarily dryland, might be much more important as the weather changes over the years and we get into these weather patterns. Okay, this is classing office data from Florence, and this is the Florence classing office does all the cotton from Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And as you can see, we can grow some pretty darn good cotton here in the Southeast. The problem with Southeastern cotton is it's highly variable, as you can see. And that variability is not only year to year, but it's also within the field and within the plant. And the textile industry has known this for a long time. Here's a quote from Helmut Dusen, the average uniformity of fiber strength within the bowl from plant to plant and from field to field is as important as raising the average fiber strength, keeping the uniformity. One of our own, Hal Lewis, also has been talking about uniformity for a long time. Talking to the breeders, he said we should pay at least as much attention to sources of variance in fiber length, strength, and micronair as we do to the magnitude of these fiber properties. So working with Judy, with the APHIS, and more recently with the Clemson Quality Lab, we were able to do a bunch of studies looking at fiber variability. Back to our conservation tillage study that I just talked about. One thing we did find was it wasn't real strong, but like with the irrigation work, where we had conservation tillage, better plant water, we had less within canopy variability for fiber properties than we did with conservation tillage. For fiber length especially, this happened routinely throughout in this study for a couple years. But was even more important, that's a terrible picture, was the differences in soil types were even more dramatic. This is a bono sand, a deep sand. This is a better soil. And you can see that the variability for micronair in 1998, the first year of the drought, ranged from 4.8 to 3.6. Whereas on the Norfolk soil, it ranged from about 4.5 to 4.0, much less variability on the better soil. Same thing in a drier year, where the drought occurred later, more variability on the dry soil than on the non-dry soil. More recently, we did a study where we looked at no-till cotton with full season variety versus a short season variety, and I did this work with John Folk and Gary Gamble at Clemson, where we took a meter of row and tagged every bowl within that meter, and to see if we had an interaction between relative maturity and canopy position. And basically what we found was no interaction. This is the full season variety, the short season, but within the canopy, very little interaction for fiber properties. You can see this is due to more of a drought period here. What was also interesting is for the longest time, people were saying, and it is true, that bowls farther out on the plant are poorer quality, but at least in this study, comparing first and second position bowls, we basically found that the first position bowls are the second position bowls when plotted by flowering date, not by canopy position, but those bowls in the second position were as good as the bowls in the first position that flowered on the exact same day. Which means this is more of an environmental influence on canopy positions rather than a anything within the plant itself. One other thing John Folk is doing, this is kind of interesting. He's taking the histograms for the fiber length distributions in this study and comparing 555 to 1218, and this is just an example of what he's doing, but basically what he's found is that the within bowl variability for these two cultivars is quite a bit different, obviously, and we know that 555 has a little higher short fiber content, but just the width of this peak for 555 is different than 1218. And so this might be one thing we can breed for more uniform fiber properties. Okay, we got a long way to go to improve the uniformity of cotton in the Southeast. Try to get fields like this with nice uniform fibers, but that was some of the data we collected. Okay, now for something totally different. Just a minute or two to talk about some work I've been doing with some soil scientists in our lab who have worked out a way to pull the phosphorus from animal manures. Now, for those of you across the Southeast, we all have chicken problems with too much phosphorus being applied to the lands from the chickens. North Carolina has way too many hogs for land application manures. So these guys figured out a way to pull the phosphorus out of these these waste materials. Basically, it comes into a rock that looks something like this. And then we made it into fertilizer-sized pellets. These are the industry standards, and ran a quick test to see how good a phosphorus material this is. And basically what we found was this is phosphorus pulled from swine wastewater, that the small particle size is just as good as the triple superphosphate, which was our control. The big particle size didn't dissolve as fast, as you can see here, nice and flat, making us think that this might be a nice fertilizer, especially for lawns, for short or for slow release. For phosphorus from the chicken litter, similar responses. Again, these are the small particle sizes, but in this experiment, we compared the recovered phosphorus to phosphorus that in poultry litter, and basically what we found, this recovered phosphorus was basically just as good as crap. Exact same as the poultry litter. Okay, and we just started doing field experiments with this. Okay, I wanted to end it up with some work that we're doing now with Todd Campbell and a very talented postdoc that we have working with us, Wong Kung Park. And this work is working on the cotton aquaporins. And basically, the aquaporins are proteins in plant cell membranes that let water move between cells. Not only water, but CO2 and some other molecules that they're finding, including some nutrients. But our idea is if we can manipulate or find alleles for that give us better water use efficiency, find alleles of these aquaporin proteins that'll give us more water use efficiency. And this is some data from the plant phys literature from back in 2003, where they overexpressed a couple of different cotton aquaporins, PIP1, B2, and PIP1B3. And in that study, where they overexpressed these genes, they got bigger tobacco plants for both gene, for both of those types, than from the wild type. And here are the growth rates for the two that where they were overexpressing the genes. Here's the growth rate for the wild type. Now, when they stressed the plants, when they stressed the plants, these plants used up all the water and died faster. But the important thing is that we can manipulate these genes to manipulate water uptake and water use. And so we thought this was a good idea to get going in. So we hired this postdoc, and so far he's identified 61 new aquaporin genes in cotton. There's 70 now that are known. There was 9 before that we knew. These 61 genes are representative of all 5 of the known classes of aquaporins, in either in the plasma membranes, the tonoplast, the NIPS, the NOD26-like proteins, the small proteins, small basic intrinsic proteins, and then these XIPs. They're called XIP because they're unknown, and we did find one of those too, or one kind of found one of these too. We got a little bit of expression data already that he took this summer, where he took it from a leaf, a sample from a leaf, and from roots from a plants that were basically minus 14 bars. That's not megapascals, but minus 14 bars, and from a plant that was at minus 27 bars when we sampled, and this was sampled on the same day. And you can see a difference between root and leaf expression for some of the aquaporins. But you can also see, for those being expressed, different amounts being expressed of messenger RNA, more different amounts of gene action between the wet and the dry plants. So I'm kind of excited about this work. Again, more this TIP2 in the dry plant than in the irrigated plant. So I'm kind of excited about this aquaporin research. I think we might be able to lead to good things, and this preliminary expression data looks pretty good. And with that, I'll just leave you with a view from my office window. And I got 5 seconds left. Sure, go ahead.
You were saying that your subsoiling was necessary every other year to maximize and break the pan.
Right.
But is that included in your conservation tillage? And that is like a normal practice and still considered conservation tillage, right?
Well, actually, I guess I didn't make that point very good. But really what it tells us is we can do strict no-till. We don't have to run that subsoiler every year. If we use control traffic, especially with GPS steering assistance, we don't have to put those soil subsoilers out every year. And a bunch of the Southeast is using a strip-till rig with the rolling baskets and the like. Probably don't need to do that. We can go strict no-till, at least for a couple of years. And since we know that if we keep traffic off those strips, since we know that the rain is causing the recompaction, dry years, you might be able to go 3, 4, 5 years. We hope. Of course, if we get 90 inches like Louisiana got, we might have to do it every year. But we can predict pretty much when it's going to occur and when it's going to need subsoiling.
Thank you, Phil.